Good afternoon, and welcome to the Easter Seals Project Action Online Conference on Pedestrian Access, Policy, Design, and Importance of Accessible Pedestrian Environments for Livable Communities. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions after today's presentations. At that time, an operator will give instructions on how to ask your question. If you should need assistance during the conference, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touch-tone phone. This conference is being recorded. I would like to turn the conference over to Christy Ross. Ms. Ross, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. Welcome, everyone. Easter Seals Project Action is happy to present to you the first session in a series of three for our first ever online conference on pedestrian access. The title of the conference is Building Livable Communities Through Increased Pedestrian Access, and today's session is titled Policy, Design, and Importance of Accessible Pedestrian Environments for Livable Communities. Today's session will be presented by Jana Linett with AARP's Public Policy Institute and Scott Winley from the U.S. Access Board. Easter Seals Project Action has partnered with the National Center on Senior Transportation and the Pedestrian and Bicycle Information Center to bring this series of sessions to you. I want to thank both organizations for their hard work and expertise on this project. We will hear more about the National Center on Senior Transportation in just a bit. And for those of you that are not familiar with the Pedestrian and Bicycle Information Center, they offer information about health and safety, engineering, advocacy, education, enforcement, access, and mobility for pedestrians, including transit users, and bicyclists. As I mentioned, I'll be turning the session over in just a minute to Lucinda Shannon from the NCST. She's a training and technical assistance specialist. This session is being brought to you both via phone and internet. Instructions on joining the webinar were emailed to registered participants. If you are having trouble connecting to the internet portion of this event, there are a couple of troubleshooting bits of advice I can give you. You can try downloading the plugin again. There has recently been an update on some of the browsers that may affect your ability to access the room, and downloading the plugin may correct that error. You may also join the room via the web-based version, and this link may be found under where it says, click here to enter the room. If you continue to have trouble, please email my colleague, Stan Tibbs, at stibbs@easterseals.com, and that's stibbs@easterseals.com. Another option, if you choose not to try to fix the connection problem, is to go to the event webpage and download the PowerPoint presentation. That way you can follow along and not miss a thing. I want to remind everybody that the call is being recorded and transcribed, and you can visit our website, projectaction.org, to obtain a PDF or text format of the transcript, or send an email request to espadistancelearning@easterseals.com to obtain a copy in Braille or audio CD. As I mentioned, this is only the first session in a three-part series on pedestrian access. Tomorrow, Wednesday, May 19th, we will hear from Michael Ronkin on making streets accessible to all. And finally, the last session will be on this Thursday, the 20th, and in that session we will hear from Peter Lagerway on the power of 25. During each session, we'll take a few minutes to discuss the services provided by each co-sponsor so that you can add to your list of resources when working on accessible transportation in your community. Today we're going to hear about the NCST, and with that, I'm going to turn the session over to Lucinda Shannon from the National Center on Senior Transportation.
Thank you, Christy. Hi, everyone. I'm Lucinda Shannon, a training and technical assistance specialist with the National Center on Senior Transportation. I've worked in the aging and disability field for 7 years. Prior coming to the NCST, I worked with Project Action. I have a degree in public policy and administration from the University of Massachusetts, and I'm really excited about this online conference. I'd like to thank Christy Ross from Easter Seals Project Action and Charlie Zagier from the Pedestrian and Bicycle Information Center for all their help with putting this together. And I'm excited to be presenting with Jana Linett today from AARP. She did an excellent presentation on Complete Streets for NCST in November of this year. The NCST is funded through a cooperative agreement with the United States Department of Transportation Federal Transit Administration in partnership with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration on Aging. The NCST's mission is to increase transportation options for older adults and enhance their ability to live independently within their community. We work with local governments, transportation providers, the Aging Network, local communities, and others to help improve and expand transportation options for older adults. We are a training and technical assistance center very similar to Easter Seals Project Action. Our four major functions are training, technical assistance, outreach, and research. Training today is a perfect example. We provide online distance learning events. We have conference calls and webinars. For technical assistance, we have a toll-free number and an email address. People can call in with questions about technical assistance, and we'll do a little bit of research and get back to you. For outreach, we go to conferences and present. We disseminate useful materials. We have a website and a newsletter, and I'll give you instructions on how to sign up for those in a minute. And we also provide funding for demonstration grants, research, and student scholar programs. So what does this mean for you? How can you be more involved with the NCST? You can visit our website at www.seniortransportation.net and sign up for the NCST print and e-newsletters. The e-newsletter is a monthly newsletter, and it will have all of our training and resource opportunities on it. You can also participate in an upcoming NCST-sponsored webinar or training session. Invite NCST to present at an upcoming conference or host an individualized training teleconference. Share your successes with us and call or email NCST with questions. We look forward to hearing from you.
All right. Thank you so much, Lucinda. The NCST does provide a lot of great resources on dealing with transportation for older adults. So thank you, and we're happy to work with you on this project. So with that, I want to introduce our speakers for today's session. Jana Leinert is a Senior Strategic Policy Advisor with the AARP Public Policy Institute, where her research focuses on transportation and livable communities. Her recent research and project management activities resulted in PPI publications titled Planning Complete Streets for an Aging America, Policy Options to Improve Specialized Transportation, and Opportunities for Creating Livable Communities. Prior to her employment with AARP, Jana was the Director of Transportation Planning for the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, where she designed and managed a groundbreaking study on the linkage between land use and the mobility of older adults. Jana also represents AARP on the NCST Steering Committee. And Scott Winley joined the Access Board in March of 1997. He previously worked for 2 years with the Center for Universal Design in Raleigh, North Carolina, as a technical assistance specialist. Before that, he worked as an intern architect for the Facility Planning Department of the University of Idaho for 3 years. Scott received a Bachelor of Architecture degree from the University of Idaho. Currently at the board, Scott oversees staff work on the board's public right-of-way rulemaking and provides technical assistance and training on the ADA guidelines and other standards. We will follow the presentations today with questions from you. At that time, we'll receive additional instructions from our Better World operator on how you can pose your questions to our presenters. Now with that, it's a pleasure to turn the session over to Jana to get us started.
Okay, thank you, Christy. And welcome, everyone, to our webinar. I'm going to focus my comments this afternoon, and for those on the West Coast, this morning, I guess, focusing comments on the policy framework for creating livable communities and accessible pedestrian environments. I'd like to begin just by giving an overview of a few definitions of livable communities to get us started. And this is a definition that I pulled from a Department of Transportation website. And the Washington DOT defines livable communities as those that provide and promote civic engagement, a sense of place, safe, sustainable choices, not only for transportation, but a variety of community elements, such as housing, education, cultural diversity, and recreation. Now, the National Council on Disability defines livable communities as those that provide affordable and accessible housing. They put a lot of emphasis on accessibility, inclusiveness of the physical environment, all with trying to make sure that people are given opportunities for work, volunteerism, educational opportunities, etc. And AARP's own definition of livable communities are those that are safe, that provide affordable and appropriate housing, supportive community features and services, adequate mobility options, which together facilitate personal independence and the engagement of residents in civic and social life. So when we're talking about livable communities, we're talking about much more than just providing transportation from A to B. We're really talking about how do we create those community connections, those social engagement opportunities for people to live a high quality of life and really be engaged in their community. Now, I was thinking in preparing this presentation, what are some of the benefits of improved pedestrian access? And these are just a few things that came to my mind immediately. One is the need and the opportunity for more economic and social opportunities for all members of a community. Walkable communities help create life on the streets, improve community connections, help to make vibrant neighborhoods where these types of connections can happen, improve access to public transportation, which leads to greater independence and quality of life. And I should also mention health benefits of having a walkable community. Now, we are faced with a very large challenge in transitioning toward a more walkable, accessible community. And partly fueling this challenge is our changing demographics. And given that I work for AARP, much of my focus is on the aging demographic of our nation. But that's not to say that we don't do this for all members of the community as well. So for instance, in 2010, our population 65 and older was about 12.5% to 13% of the total population. In the next 20 years, we're expecting that share to grow to about 19-20% and holding steady through 2050. We also know from polling our members that most older adults want to remain in their homes and communities for as long as possible. Those aged 65 to 74, almost 90% say they want to remain in their communities as opposed to switching communities, going to a retirement destination, or even more so avoiding the desire to avoid institutionalization. And that desire to remain in community and connected to the people they know and love, their churches, etc., is even stronger for the 75 and older. And some demographers have said that the baby boom generation, those that are entering the 65 plus as of next year when they begin to turn 65, are even more attached to community and are very much desiring to stay rooted where they live today in their suburban neighborhoods, et cetera. Now, one of the challenges with that is that our older population increasingly resides in suburban areas. About 70% of those 65 and older reside in suburban areas today, and we know that often these areas are not well served by public transportation. The auto is king. About 1 in 5 American 65 and older do not drive and report that they about 50% stay home on any given day, in part because they lack transportation options. Transportation use among older adults has been declining for decades. There's some preliminary analysis of the 2009 National Household Travel Survey gives us some pause and hope that this trend may have stabilized. But still, transit ridership is fairly low overall. In 2008, more than 800 pedestrians aged 65 and older were hit and killed by motor vehicles, another 7,000 injured. Older adults are disproportionately represented in fatal accidents. Now, there are many victims across the age spectrum who suffer from inaccessible pedestrian ways. About 4,000 pedestrians were killed in 2008 here in the United States, another nearly 70,000 injured. Older adults are especially vulnerable. The population group 65 and older has the highest fatality rates of any population cohort. So while they were about 13% of the population in 2008, they suffered about 14% of all motor vehicle fatalities and a staggering 19% of pedestrian fatalities. Now, when we poll older adults, we find that they are not content with the situation in their community. About 13% give their communities a failing grade, D or F, on well-designed and maintained streets. About 20% give their communities failing grades on transportation alternatives for persons with disabilities or health problems. 31% sidewalks going to where you want to go. 35% on bike accommodations, and nearly 40% on dependable public transportation. And in a more recent survey conducted in 2008, 40% of those 50 and older said they do not have adequate sidewalks in their neighborhoods. Nearly half said they cannot cross the main roads in their neighborhood safely. And more than half of those living in what we consider inhospitable neighborhoods said they would walk and ride their bikes more if conditions improved. Now, the next series of slides are some images of the problem that's out there. And these are fairly ubiquitous images across the United States, from the missing sidewalks where this woman has to walk in along a dirt path along a suburban thoroughfare to get from A to B, where you have utility poles that drop down in the middle of the sidewalk and prevent persons in wheelchairs or moms with strollers from being able to pass through. This image where somehow the sidewalk segments simply do not align at this intersection, and the poor individual in a wheelchair is forced out onto the street. And my all-time favorite, the sidewalk that ends at the sign that says, caution, deaf and blind children. I don't think this is what Shel Silverstein meant in his internationally renowned children's poetry book, Where the Sidewalk Ends. Luckily, there are some policy solutions out there and design solutions, and we're seeing some very positive developments at the federal, state, and local levels. First up at the federal level is the Federal Interagency Partnership for Sustainable Communities that was formed by U.S. Department of Transportation, Housing and Urban Development, and U.S. EPA this past year. And second is the recent March announcement, an executive order by the Secretary LaHood, USDOT policy on pedestrian and bicycle accommodations. And finally, the overall Complete Streets policy movement that's taking place at all levels of government. Now, the Federal Interagency Partnership's livability principles include providing more transportation choices, promoting equitable, affordable housing, enhancing economic competitiveness, supporting existing communities, coordinating policies and leveraging investment, and valuing existing communities and neighborhoods. Very similar to the other livable communities definitions that I covered earlier. Now, Secretary LaHood's recent announcement of a strengthened USDOT policy on bicycle and pedestrian accommodations was announced via his blog. And he introduced it by saying that this is the end of favoring motorized transportation at the expense of non-motorized. And this caused quite a stir out there in the blogosphere, something that many in the pedestrian and bicycle advocacy communities fully embrace and support, and with lots of questions from other segments of the industry questioning as to where the priorities are of the current administration. But as LaHood describes it, he's talking about opportunities where people can take their child to school, visit a park, get to work, do many of the day-to-day activities without having to rely on the private automobile, providing transportation choices, which is fundamental to livable communities. The USDOT policy It directs transportation agencies that receive federal funding to consider walking and bicycling as equals with other transportation modes, emphasizing linkages to transit. Also ensure convenient choices for people of all ages and abilities, and really to look to go beyond minimum design standards. And in essence, the DOT policy statement is a complete streets policy statement. So when we talk about complete streets, what exactly are we referring to? Well, a complete street is one that's safe, comfortable, and convenient for travel by any mode, automobile, foot, bicycle, and transit, regardless of age and ability. And some of the features that are in this visual that would help to complete the street are wide sidewalks, a buffer using street trees and parking, a buffer for the pedestrians, bicycle accommodations, well-marked crosswalks, ample refuge space for someone in a wheelchair to rest if they're not able to get all the way across the intersection, park benches, bus stops that have shelters and benches. And again, this is an image that's applicable for a moderate density, mixed-use town center type of neighborhood. Complete streets as a concept is really applicable to any type of land use pattern. The design of the street will vary by land use pattern. So why have a complete streets policy? Well, for one, a complete streets policy ensures that the entire right-of-way is planned, designed, and operated to provide safe access for all users. We're trying to change the day-to-day practice within our transportation agencies. It's really about a cultural shift that enables us to think through the needs of all road users as part of everyday transportation planning and design. We're trying to make sure that we avoid the project-by-project fight over the design of the network and really start with the vision for what it is that we want the transportation network to provide. A complete streets policy should also be about creating a network of roads that serve all users, not a single road in a community. And this network is so important because we want to be able to get throughout the community, A to B to C to D, and by many different modes. This image shows a traditional street design with lots of interconnected streets juxtaposed at the bottom with a more suburban street design that has a lot of loops, lollipops, the cul-de-sac that makes it much more difficult to go from home to shopping to school by any means other than the automobile. We also want to have a complete streets policy to help shift transportation investments so that they do create better streets. And we're not asking for new pots of money. We're asking that the existing pots of money be used in a different way to ensure access. Complete streets policies are not a mandate for an immediate retrofit. They're not a silver bullet in that they don't address some of the land use issues, which we know are fundamental to really creating communities that are very walkable and accessible. And they're not a design prescription, as I've mentioned before. There's no single cross-section for a complete street. It really is very context-specific. So here are the ideal elements of a complete streets policy. First, it needs to set a vision of what the community wants to attain from its transportation network. It should include all modes of transportation. It should apply to all transportation projects and phases, from planning, design, construction, reconstruction, but also to operations and maintenance. So when it's time to repave a street, that's an opportunity to go back in and restripe that street in a different way to accommodate other modes. It should specify exceptions with high-level management approval. Again, it's context-sensitive. It should emphasize connectivity, and it should apply flexible standards that use the latest design standards, and also set performance standards, anything from saying, you know, talking about the total number of additional miles of sidewalk facilities to actually measuring an increase in walk rates in the community and a decrease in pedestrian injury and fatality rates. And the IDEAL policy will also cover implementation steps. Many of the more recent state policies, such as that in Hawaii, call out for a task force to be formed of interdisciplinary teams of planners, engineers, community members, to think through what are the design and planning documents that will have to be updated in order to implement the Complete Streets policy. Now, at this point in time, there are over 130 communities that have committed to a Complete Streets approach. And of these policies, the majority take the form of legislation or ordinances, resolutions, internal policies, or policy statements as part of an overall comprehensive land use and transportation plan. There are a few cases, such as that in San Diego, where the policy was actually written into a tax ordinance that says any money spent from this fund will be used for pedestrian and bicycle facilities. Complete Streets policies are really being driven at the local level. About 75% of all of the 130 policies out there to date, or actually more than 130 policies, because some communities have more than one policy embedded in their planning and design documents. But about 75% of those policies are city or county policies, and then about 20 policies are statewide policies. And those, again, can apply much more comprehensively across different jurisdictions and road types. Since 1971, in Portland's passage, or I should say Oregon's passage of the bike law, we've had a Complete Streets policy in place in the country, even though it was not called Complete Streets. The name Complete Streets really came about around 2000, and since 2006, there's really been a great increase in the number of Complete Streets policies. In 2009, we had about 44 Complete Streets policies adopted in the nation. As part of our project, Planning Complete Streets for an Aging America, we looked and evaluated about 80 Complete Streets policies in the country and looked at things like modes covered, the policy reach, whether they applied only to state roads or to local roads as well, whether the purpose and vision was very comprehensive, allowed for exceptions, coverage, whether, again, it dealt beyond just reconstruction projects, but also talked about the operations and maintenance and was context-specific. And so all of that information on those policies with links to those policies can be found in our Planning Complete Streets for an Aging America study. One of the findings of the study, because we also did an online survey of transportation planners and engineers, was about two-thirds of planners and engineers had not yet begun considering the needs of older users in their multimodal planning. And, okay, so as part of our evaluation of Complete Streets policies, we looked at whether those policies explicitly addressed the needs of older persons and persons with disabilities. Less than a third of the policies explicitly addressed the needs of persons with older persons. About 7 in 10 of the policies explicitly mentioned persons with disabilities. Now, one of our recommendations, overarching recommendations in the report, is that we need to slow our urban and suburban streets down in order to complete the street, provide increased safety for all users. And our bar chart here is following the header of the slide to slow down, and I don't think it's going to pop into the presentation. But if it were to pop in, you would see that at 40 miles per hour, if you're a pedestrian hit by a vehicle traveling 40 miles per hour, you have an 85% chance of dying. If we reduce the speed down to 20 miles per hour, the chance of death drops down to 5%. So fatality rates are very much tied to speed of traffic. Another one of our recommendations in really endorsements of the new regulatory change as part of the manual on uniform traffic control devices is that we need to use a slower assumed walking speed of the average pedestrian, dropping it down from 4 feet per second down to 3.5 feet per second to give older persons and others who need a little bit more time, adequate time to get across the street. And you can see in this photograph that at the current timing of 4 feet per second, the older couple would not have adequate time. They'd still have another lane of traffic to go in order to get across the street. One of the things to mention for advocates out there is that the changes to the MUTCD, while they've been adopted by the Federal Highway Administration, states and localities have 10 years to actually implement those changes. So being aware of the need to make these signal timing changes is very important and should be emphasized out there in communities. Now, another one of our recommendations, we provided refinements to the Federal Highways Design Handbook for older drivers and pedestrians as part of their update to that document. And just as an example, one of their recommendations for older drivers is that older drivers need more rounded turns, longer curb radii of the 25 to 30 foot length in order to feel have more comfort in making a turn. Older drivers as a group tend to not like really sharp turns. They may either hit the curb or swing a little too wide and into oncoming traffic. But a longer curb radii can also encourage younger drivers to take the turn too fast and put pedestrians at risk. So one of the ways to compensate for this and balance the needs of both older drivers and pedestrians of all ages is to add parallel parking and bike lanes, as shown in the figure on the left. You essentially have the same effective curb radius. Complete streets is highly beneficial for public transportation users. And when we put in bus stops without really designing the approach for the pedestrian to access the bus stop, we can leave people in very dangerous situations as well as situations where there's not a whole lot of dignity that one feels waiting for the bus at this stop. But complete streets, because it really requires us to think through the needs of all users, can create absolutely fabulous bus stops that are very welcoming to public transportation users, as is shown in this photograph. Another benefit to transit agencies of complete streets is the possibility that they can save some money on ADA paratransit costs by making all of their bus stops more accessible. And this is a study, these numbers are a study from the Maryland Transit Administration in Montgomery County. They found that bus stop improvements cost anywhere from $7,000 to $58,000, the higher expense being to put in a bus shelter bench and reconstruct sidewalk approaches to the bus stop. But a single year of ADA paratransit service for a daily commuter can be as high as about $38,500. So there is some positive, potentially positive benefit by providing those with enough mobility who could transfer a portion, at least, of their trips to the fixed route public transportation system. Now, I've mentioned a couple of federal initiatives. Another thing that's happening on Capitol Hill is the Complete Streets Act, which is a bill introduced by Senators Harkin and Representative Matsui that directs states and MPOs to adopt complete streets policies for federally funded projects within 2 years. This is not law yet, but we are definitely supporting passage of this act, or at least incorporation of the intent of this bill into the next reauthorization. At the state and local levels, AARP's advocacy work has also included advocacy on complete streets. And last month, our New York State office did these sidewalk and street surveys. And by the way, this survey toolkit is available on our website. and is available to anyone. And they took this a refined update of this sidewalk and street surveys and went out and surveyed over 500 streets and intersections, engaging 2,000 volunteers across the state and generating more than 100 media articles to draw attention to a bill that they're looking at in their state legislature on complete streets, and really emphasizing that complete streets can make a very positive difference in the lives of older adults and persons of all ages. So with that, I'm going to skip the last two slides and just wrap up by saying that our Planning Complete Streets for an Aging America report, as well as all of our other livable communities work, is available on our website, and that's www.aarp.org/PPI for the Public Policy Institute, and you can click on Livable Communities and get to that. So with that, that concludes my comments.
All right, thank you so much, Jana. We're going to make sure and leave lots of time for questions, so we're going to go ahead and move on to Scott.
Okay. All right, I'll let Christy get to the beginning of my slides. Basically, what I'm going to talk to you about today is a little bit about what pedestrians we're designing for, or what we're thinking about when we're talking about accessibility. Also, we're going to talk a lot about the public right-of-way guidelines that the Access Board is developing, as well as just some overall barriers to access that are generally out there. So, who are the design pedestrians? They could be a person with a vision impairment that uses a guide dog. It could be an older couple. One maybe has some sight issues, another one maybe has some hearing issues. Who knows? The other issues that we may have is people using manual wheelchairs or people using power chairs or scooters. We're trying to address all the needs of these types of pedestrians. So, we also have the jocks out there that can jump the Susan comes up here. We have people in crutches and braces, that kind of thing. We also, hopefully we have we have some people that are jocks that maybe be able to jump curbs. We aren't designing for those guys, okay? We're only designing for the people that use their wheelchair in a normal fashion. Cognitive disabilities can come into this as well. Where in these slides, or these photos, we have a person who has a cognitive impairment that's actually in the circulatory roadway of a roundabout and can't figure out where he's supposed to be. Okay, and then the other photo shows a very long crossing. This is a problem even for what looks like a very healthy older person. But it's hard for any of us to get across an intersection this long. So trying to shorten the pedestrian route as well. This is what I call the cookie cutter curb ramp, but it also shows you the placement for the detectable warning on a curb ramp. And what we need here is detectable changes at transitions from the sidewalk to the street and from the street to the sidewalk. So what we've done with the detectable warning is it essentially replaces the curb for a blind pedestrian. Okay, I always refer to it as a stop line for a blind pedestrian. and the next slide's gonna show us some things and other things about usable curb ramps. You want perpendicular grade breaks. Part of that is because if you all know, wheelchairs do not function like cars. They don't flex. If they need to hit the transition of the curb, with both wheels at the same time, both front wheels and both back wheels, or else you're going to have a teetering situation where if you lose the use of your drive wheel, you can go whatever direction it's going to go because you've lost half of the control of the wheelchair. So we, in our guidelines and in our technical assistance that the Access Board does, we try to encourage the grade break to be perpendicular. So you end up with, instead of trapezoidal curb ramps, you have actual rectangular curb ramps that have a grade break that's perpendicular to your direction of travel. The other things we want to be aware of is the geometry. Counter slopes can cause a lot of instability. If there's a major transition from the curb ramp to the crown of the road, and it's an abrupt transition, that can cause some real problems for a lot of users. It can cause a manual chair, like shown in these graphics, make them, you can tip over backwards. A smoother transition would be one where you provide a flat portion in the gutter section before you start having to deal with the crown of the roadway. Now, in a lot of cities, they've resurfaced the road so many times that the crown isn't what it was originally. The crown of the road is quite severe because they've put resurfacing on top of resurfacing on top of resurfacing. That becomes a real problem for both manual chair users as well as power chair users, because they can get their power chair users can get their rear wheels stuck and not be able to proceed because their drive wheel comes up off the ground. Some other things you want to be aware of is not having large joints between pavers. You want to minimize those joints between the pavers because you can get your casters stuck, both for manual chairs and for power chairs. You get your casters stuck in those grooves. There's maneuvering space needed at the top of the curb ramp. You don't want to have to be making a turn actually on the curb ramp. You want to be able to be done using the curb ramp and then turn, so you need sufficient room for that. And that would, in our guidelines, is 48 inches minimum. So just to give you a little bit of history, thanks. We began work on the public rights-of-way guidelines a long while ago. This is before I actually was with the Access Board, 5 years before. We attempted to provide a supplement to ADAG in 1992. Section 14 was also put out as a interim final rule in 1994. What we found from this is that we found that there was a lot of confusion. A lot of users and a lot of transportation professionals thought we were wanting them to flatten the earth tomorrow and have everything be perfect. So what we found out is we needed to do a lot of outreach and training. And so we did a lot of that, as well as we developed a sidewalk video and design manual. Both of those came out in 1997. We then have formed an advisory committee in 1999 to help us redevelop the public right-of-way guidelines, and they gave that report to the board at a Transportation Research Board meeting in January of 2001. We put out a draft of the guidelines in June of 2002 and a revised draft in November of 2005. The next steps for us are to put out a proposed rule, hopefully by the end of this year, and hopefully a final rule shortly thereafter. What we've done with the public right-of-way is we've tried to adapt ADAG to the rights-of-way environment. It'll be a standalone document using right-of-way measures and language, using grade instead of slope, that type of thing. Some of the key differences that we will have in there is that the slope limit of an accessible route are not applied to sidewalks. So sidewalks aren't limited to an 8.3% grade, They don't have to have handrails on both sides if they exceed 5% grade. I mean, I think we all recognize we don't want to have two sets of handrails on a sidewalk going everywhere. That would just be craziness. And there's no path of travel obligation. If I cross Main Street and turn left, and the guy behind me who's in a wheelchair as well crosses the same Main Street and turns right, which one is the path of travel for the project? So we aren't including a path of travel obligation that you see in the building realm of ADAG. You see a requirement to provide a path of travel to the altered area, but you know, knowing what that path of travel is going to be is impossible, so we limit it to the project scope. And we're also have new communication features or changes to communication features. Detectable warnings have some different requirements than they had originally. And APS, which is accessible pedestrian signals, they will also be required whenever a visual pedestrian signal is provided. The layout of the guidelines is set up in four chapters. First one is application and administration. That's just all the gobbledygook that the federal regulations require. And then, a lot of the definitions and things like that. And then the scoping chapter, which says 5% of this or 10% of that has to be accessible. That's what the scoping requirements are. And then the technical provisions, which tells you all the widths, depths, and slopes, and counter slopes, and cross slopes. Those types of things are all laid out in Chapter 3. And then what we've done with Chapter 4 is we've tried to provide any supplemental information that you may need in the right-of-way that comes directly from ADAG. It's just reprinted. So in new construction, the cornfield in Kansas, we would expect quite a high level of accessibility. Because saying that I can't achieve your slope requirements because of the slope of my road out there in this cornfield, that's not going to work. So we expect that's kind of the gold standard. In new construction, we expect a pretty high level of accessibility. But the reality of life is that most public right-of-ways, you're dealing with alteration work because most of our roads and streets and sidewalks have been already developed, and we're basically just retrofitting existing things. So in alterations, we may not be able to optimize the conditions for every user, but we follow new construction guidelines to the maximum extent feasible and then document why we can't achieve something. If we can't achieve a particular provision that's in the guidelines, you want to document the reason why you can't do that. And that could, you know, alterations can range between resurfacing, which is showing you the asphalt being laid down over the top of an existing roadway in the drawing on the left, and or picture on the left, and then it could be a total reconstruction of a roadway like you see in the picture on the right. So there's different levels of requirements there. If all you're doing is doing a resurfacing, that's not going to have the same level of expectation of fixing everything that's wrong with a particular section of sidewalk or roadway. But if you're totally tearing it out and putting it back in, there's probably a higher level of expectation. But still, you do have to work in both of those situations. You have to work within the limits of your existing parameters. So you have to the maximum extent feasible. The basic requirements, just real quick, is you want to provide a 4-foot wide minimum pedestrian access route. That's what we're referring to this an accessible route out in the streets, sidewalks, we're calling a pedestrian access route because it has different requirements than an accessible route in a building. Why does it need to be a foot wider in the right-of-way versus inside a building? My scenario I always tell people in my trainings is that, you know, I'm wheeling down a hallway and Christy needs to get past me in the hallway, and I get a little close to the wall, so I scrape up a little bit of the wallpaper in the process of trying to move out of her way so that she can get by. That's not a big deal, okay? But if I get close to the edge on a sidewalk, that's a little more catastrophic than scratching a little bit of wallpaper or scraping a little bit of paint off the wall. So we're trying to give them a little bit more margin for error, so to speak, and just margin for being able to move around. So the PAR is 4 feet wide minimum, and it's within every sidewalk, curb ramp, and street crossing. 5 foot passing space is required if you do limit yourself to 4 feet, which actually is the minimum from the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials. If you look in the design manual from them, it actually 4 feet is the minimum. So if you do go to the minimum, you will need to provide some opportunities for an area to widen out for a person to be able to change direction and so forth. So since we gave you a big out on the slope of the sidewalk, because we're allowing it to follow the slope of the existing roadway, we expect a pretty high level of getting your cross slope to a maximum of 2%, and that's measured to the perpendicular to the PAR center line. And in new construction, again, it's going to be fairly easy to do that. In alterations, you may only be able to do a portion of the sidewalk at 2%. Because if you did the whole thing at 2%, it would ruin, say, the entrances to your shops or whatever you have on that sidewalk. So, but we would expect the 4 foot path to have a 2% cross slope. Like I said, the running slope of the PAR may match but not exceed that of the adjacent roadway. So, you know, we're not asking you to stick handrails on both sides of your sidewalk and a level landing at every 30 inches of rise like it is a ramp. That wouldn't work in our world today. But when the pedestrian route departs from the roadway slope and is not within the roadway border, it must meet the applicable guidelines developed for it. If it's actually a sidewalk and it's just happens to be off of the roadway, then it would still need to meet the requirements of an accessible route as far as slope and cross slope. But if it's out, you know, if it's trail out to, over to the grandma's house through the woods, then we would want it to meet the trail guidelines that are also under development and available on our website as well. So what do you do when you have a construction project in the middle of your pedestrian route? Well, we're going to expect when the PAR is detoured, you provide an alternate route with a trailable edge. And the same site is best if feasible. And that's consistent with MUTCD. MUTCD requires the same thing. They require it to be on the same side of the street if possible. But if there's some reason, safety reasons or whatever, you need to have the pedestrians on the other side of the street, that's allowable. But it's always a good idea to keep them on the same side of the street, because when is a pedestrian most vulnerable is when he's actually crossing the street. And if you're requiring him to cross two times when before you started your little project, you didn't have to cross at all. That's doubling or more his exposure. So the other things you need in an alternate circulation path, besides a trailable edge for a blind pedestrian to know where that alternate route goes, you also need curb ramps. They could be more permanent, like the one you see on the left, because this is a DC projects, and DC projects tend to be a little more permanent than temporary. I can say that because I live here. Or it could be a temporary where it's done with plywood or, you know, any, you know, just laying down some asphalt. But what you want to remember is that if you got to do a curb ramp off, you also got to do a curb ramp back on to the sidewalk at the end of the circulation route. I've seen many circulation routes that had a great curb ramp at the beginning of the circulation route and you get to the end of it and they've got a curb. Like somebody didn't, you know, connect the dots. So you want to be mindful of protruding objects. And basically, it's a 4-inch maximum across the whole width of the pedestrian walkway. This isn't just for the PAR, because a blind pedestrian isn't necessarily going to be walking on the portion of the sidewalk that is at 2% cross slope and is 4 feet wide for a person in a wheelchair. They will be walking on any portion of the sidewalk that they wish to. So you want to make sure that you be mindful of them across the whole width of the pedestrian walkway. And elements above 27 inches and below 80 inches aren't detectable by cane. So if you have things overhead, you want to make sure that you have some way of barricading that so that the person doesn't whack their head on, say, like this is the exposed staircase that you see on the right. If you have to put signs, construction signs out, you want to put a base on it that's cane detectable and makes it so that the sign doesn't stick out more than 4 inches from the base. Okay? And you know, there's always better places to put signal controls as well besides right out in the sidewalk. You know, turn it 90 degrees and it'd be a lot better. So, some other things you want to do is provide a level turning space at the top of perpendicular ramps and at the bottom of a parallel ramp. That's one of the things that we've done with the public right-of-way guidelines is we've tried to develop more than one type of ramp. And so here I'm showing you a perpendicular curb ramp and a parallel curb ramp. Now, in ADAG, it never said that a ramp had to be perpendicular to the curb, but it's the only ones that ever got illustrated. And so us architects, architects and engineers that tend to look at pictures more than we read, thought that was the only type of curb ramp you could put in because it was the only one that was illustrated. But these other options have always been available. They've just never been described. So basically what we're trying to do in the public right-of-way guidelines is describe them to you and explain them how they work. So a parallel curb ramp, like the one you see on the left, is useful if you have a small right-of-way because you can slope the entire sidewalk down to a level landing and then have the level landing directed to the crossing. And those are very helpful for when you have a very narrow sidewalk and may not have the right-of-way to make a proper perpendicular curb ramp. But you want to have a turning space on all of those. So, and then there's another type of curb ramp that you may want to do, which is a combined ramp. If you have a lot of right-of-way, you can do a combined ramp, they work well. You slope the sidewalk down halfway to a landing, and then you continue it as a perpendicular curb ramp. So that's basically what we call a combined curb ramp. And then we have what is referred to in the guidelines, for lack of a better term, is a blended transition, which would be a depressed corner or a raised crossing. They are not ramp. So they don't have to have a perpendicular relationship to the street because we require them to not be more than 5% grade. So it's basically a flush transition. And all ramps and raised crossings must have detectable warnings to provide notice underfoot of the change from a pedestrian to a vehicular route. And here it shows you two examples. One is a retrofit project from Portland, Oregon, where they've done a hybrid of a pressed in concrete and then it's treated so that it'll stay together, because a lot of pressed in concrete detectable warnings fall apart shortly after they're put in. But if this one's actually treated with a surface that helps it not degrade. And then you have the fancy kind of detectable warnings like you see on the right, or in front of the White House, they have, you know, granite detectable warnings. Not sure it always fits with the requirement of a contrast, but it is a nice-looking product. So, and their detectable warnings are particularly useful in medians to give an indication of where the island is for a blind pedestrian, and cut-throughs are always easier to navigate for a blind pedestrian than a island that's been raised and lowered with ramps. Cut-throughs are always a little easier to navigate on there. And we want to, Janet talked about this a little bit, but we want to provide adequate time to cross. 3.5 feet per second measured curb to curb. In old versions of MUTCD, it was measured from the curb to the center line of the last travel lane. Okay? And I always make the joke that, you know, this isn't how I became disabled, but I was crossing the street and actually was in the last travel lane and got hit by a car. So it was a slight tap. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. But, never could understand why they were measuring it to the center line of the last travel lane. It's like you'd think you'd want to get them out of the road before you stopped counting. But so they have fixed that, say, curb to curb. They did that in 2003. And in 2009 MUTCD, it is 3.5 feet per second. So roundabouts. Roundabouts. We want to require a pedestrian signal at roundabouts where pedestrian crossings are more than one lane. So single lane roundabouts, we're okay with, because, you know, you usually can tell that the one car is stopped for you as a blind pedestrian. You know that car is stopped, and you know there's not going to be another car coming to run you over. But the problem with multi-lane roundabouts is you get the first car to stop, and you don't necessarily get the second car to stop because the first car is blocking the view of you for the second car, and he doesn't know why the first car is stopped. So it can be dangerous. Also, multi-lane roundabouts, just by their design, are actually tend to have the driver go faster, which kind of coincides with what Jana told us earlier about the speed and what the risk is at different speeds. So we have some sort of signalization requirement. We don't specify what that is. It could be a hawk. It could be a hawk, or it could be a red-yellow signal, or it could be a full-blown traffic signal. All we say is that it has to have a pedestrian-actuated signal. So, and in the realm of signals, in the guidelines, we say when new pedestrian signals are installed, they should include an APS, which is consistent with the effective communication requirements of the ADA that have been in existence from the beginning of the ADA, where if you're communicating with a particular group of people information, you need to provide that in an accessible format. And a visual signal of the raised hand and the walking man is a visual signal for everybody who can see it, that you either have a walk signal or you don't have a walk signal. The APS, the accessible pedestrian signal, is merely giving that same information to a blind pedestrian. It is not telling them that it's safe to cross. It is merely telling them that the walk signal is on. They still have to figure out if there's cars not doing what they're supposed to be doing before they cross. So, and those come in all shapes and sizes. I've got three examples here of just different formats. Some of them have the tactile arrow that's required on the button. Some of them have the tactile arrow above the button. All of them have a larger button instead of the old little tiny button that you stick your finger in there and hope there isn't something else besides the button in there when you stick your finger in there. We do require a 2-inch diameter button, so it's easy to hit it with your fist. It's easy to not have to have great dexterity to be able to get the button to work. So, as far as the other APS requirements, we require a level landing. and so does MUTCD, require us a level landing that is at all controls within the reach range. So that would be within 48 inches maximum height, and you don't want to have an obstruction that's deeper than 10 inches. Okay, so you don't want to stick it on a great big base and have it on the pole that's in the center of this, you know, 3 foot wide base. You basically have to, you know, be an acrobat to be able to push the button. So, and that needs to be a level surface, and it needs to be near, in the location that the pedestrian, accessible pedestrian signal is located. And then we also have issues with street furniture, if you have it. These are kind of becoming something that doesn't happen much anymore. But if you have a paid telephone, it should be usable by a person with a disability with a TTY and all that stuff that's already required by ADAG. But it should be out of the way so that when a person's walking through, they don't run into it. And there's a picture of a person using a drinking fountain. Drinking fountains are great, but they can be really a protruding object if they're not done properly. So you want to kind of get them out of the circulation path, but still accessible. And parking. Now we require accessible spaces. They're scoped like parking lots based upon the total provided on a block. So we're basically looking at the requirements for new construction would be a block perimeter has to have, you know, if you have X number of parking spaces in a block perimeter, then we would require X number of accessible spaces. So a lot on a street is essentially a block perimeter. And we also have different requirements based on whether it's a narrow sidewalk or a wide sidewalk. Narrow sidewalks are not required to have an access aisle, but they are required to have a clear area for a person to be able to deploy the lift onto the sidewalk. But if you have a wide sidewalk, which is which happens a lot in urban settings, we in new construction would require an access aisle so that it makes it so a person can park out towards the street a little bit if they have a passenger, or they can park closer in to the building, which is what's shown here by this truck. It's closer into the edge because, you know, the driver, that way the driver would be able to use the access aisle. So we don't designate the access aisle as far as drawing it in, but it's just there to be used so the car can park either direction, depending on if they're needing access for the driver or the passenger. And then, so that's on-street parallel parking. On-street angled parking or perpendicular parking, there's really no problem with providing an access aisle, so we don't give you any kind of wide sidewalk exceptions for that. If you have angled parking or perpendicular parking, we require an access aisle to go with the parking space. With that, I don't know if I went fast or slow.
You did great.
And this is my contact information. I just want to mention that part of my job is to answer questions. So, you know, never hesitate to send me an email or give me a call and ask me a question, because it's part of what I get paid to do. So.
All right. Thank you so much, Scott. It's now time for us to take questions from the audience. There are two ways that you can ask a question. You can either pose your question over the phone, or you can post it into the webinar chat section. We will address the chat section questions as time permits. So if you really want to ask your question, it's probably best to get in on the phone. So at this time, I want to ask our Better World operator, Bonnie, to provide instructions on how you can ask your question, and then we're going to address a couple of questions we received in advance, and then we'll take your phone questions. So, Bonnie?
Thank you. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad.
All right, so we've got a couple questions that we received in advance. I'll ask Lucinda to read those, and we'll address those, and then we'll take the phone questions.
Thanks, Christy. The first question is from Beth, and she's asking, what is the best way to work with local municipalities to ensure accessibility when bus stops are located on city, county property and are not within the jurisdiction of the transit operator? What steps do you take, who can you contact, and where can you begin?
Jana, you want to try that
one? Let me take a stab at that question. The question that's posed is really a situation that's fairly common, and I've seen it in my own transportation planning work in the Washington, D.C. area, and I'm sure it occurs in other locations as well. And with the cases that I've seen, ultimately it's the jurisdiction, the entity that owns the right-of-way at the bus stop, who tends to take ownership of that and ultimately do the physical improvements to the bus stop. But that's not to say that transit agencies don't, which typically don't own the right-of-way, they own the poles at bus stops in many cases, they still have a role to play. So I think if you're in an urban area, what I would recommend is you start, if there's not already dialogue going on between the jurisdiction and the transit agency, perhaps take it up with the Metropolitan Planning Organization to try to get this on the agenda for discussion. Ultimately, if no one is taking ownership over making improvements, then it may need to be elevated up to more of a political level and to find a champion in the elected official community who can really push this forward and make it a higher priority and put some pressure on the agencies to sit down and talk and to start moving forward on very important aspects of accessibility. Just one example from the D.C. area that I've observed is several years ago, the transit agency, in coordination with the member jurisdictions, sat down and began a project to inventory all of the bus stops in the region. And Montgomery County, and there are other counties who have done the same, but Montgomery County, I think, has moved forward with a pretty innovative way to upgrade their bus stops in a fairly efficient manner. They've formed these disciplinary teams that go out together to evaluate their bus stops and work together to do the planning and design work. And then they have construction teams to get those in place in a prioritization program that would establish which stops would get funded first, in part based on what are the easy, low-hanging carrot stops that can be improved and also what some of the higher priority stops are in terms of the numbers of people using those. So that may be one example to look to for some additional guidance. But it certainly is an issue in many communities and something that we do need to work on.
All right. Thank you, Jana. Well, we have a couple more. Lucinda?
Yeah. This next question looks like it's coming from somebody who's working on passing a complete streets legislation, and it's from Matthew. And he says that one of our comments concerned passing complete streets legislation and the misconception that these types of bills require local highway departments to redesign all of the roads and do a lot of construction projects. Could you, Jana, and Scott both discuss this a bit?
Yeah, let me take the first stab, and then Scott, if you can add to it. This is a question that we get a lot. We have a number of states and AARP offices who are working to try to get complete streets legislation passed. And I think to underscore some of the points I made earlier, complete streets, again, it's not a mandate to retrofit all the projects. We need to – it's more of establishment of a vision of what we're trying to accomplish, what our transportation system should be providing in terms of the access for all users. And it also helps to establish that vision so as transportation agencies undergo what's really a huge cultural shift in how they do business, it helps to establish a new process for how things are done. So you start from the beginning, not with just saying, okay, well, here's status quo, we're going to widen this road and then as an afterthought add sidewalks and and look at the additional cost of those sidewalks, it says, wait a second, before we go into design at all, let's look at what are the users in this transportation corridor and what are their needs. And in many urban areas, we may be talking about a reduced right-of-way, a reduced number of lanes, or looking to narrow lanes. And so you're basically taking space that would have previously been applied for vehicular traffic, and now you're freeing up some of that space for sidewalks, for bike lanes, or other types of accommodation, street trees, parallel parking, that sort of thing. And it's very, again, it's very context-sensitive, project-by-project basis. Other things to think about is some of the low-hanging fruit that with a complete streets policy, and as you get transportation professionals to think through the needs of users, you have all kinds of project opportunities that cost little or no money at all. So, for instance, signal timing. You might retime your signals to keep traffic moving at a slower speed. That costs very little money to do. Pedestrian countdown signals, installation of those, about $2,000 per signal. And reducing the assumed walking speed, it's really just the cost of retiming those signals. What drives the cost of a project is the right-of-way requirements and curb and gutter changes. For instance, if you're going from a rural highway and now you've had development occur in that area and it's moving to, you need to change that into a suburban road with curb and gutter, that's going to drive cost. But that, again, it becomes the opportunity that you design for the other modes. You add sidewalks at that point. You add bicycle accommodations at that point. So because you're already doing a fair amount of work, the incremental cost of adding the additional accommodations is very small in terms of the total project cost. Also, I think we need to think on the other side of costs and benefits. You know, what's the cost of a lost life? What's the cost of our obesity rates and some of the health implications of not having a more balanced transportation system? You know, and some of the benefits of complete streets for downtown areas, complete streets projects have really been the impetus used to attract more private sector development and revitalize many communities downtown or even strip mall areas into town centers. So there's a lot of opportunities and I think arguments that can be made for why complete streets make sense.
And I would just add to that real quick, because this is kind of the same kind of story we heard when the ADA was passed, is, oh my gosh, they want us to flatten the earth, just like here. Oh, they want us to tear out, you know, all the streets and sidewalks and do complete streets. It's not necessarily a retrofit requirement. It's merely a new construction and planned alteration requirement. If you're not fixing anything, you don't always have to spend a gob of money on it. So,
and I might add that complete streets as a policy, as a vision, it gets transportation of professionals in the community to think through what the street needs to, how the street needs to perform. And in doing that, you get much better products. You get much better streets at the end of the game. Those streets are streets that the community can embrace. I mean, how many DOTs have had projects held up for years because the community was against the type of project that they were putting in? Charlotte, North Carolina is a good example, how they passed complete streets policy, updated their urban design guidelines, and now they're creating streets that are very welcoming places for pedestrians and other users, and the community loves them, and they're willing to spend a little bit more money on those types of improvements.
All right, I think we're going to skip the last question that we received in advance, and any of the questions that we received in advance that we didn't address today, we'll address tomorrow or the next day. And Bonnie, we'll take some questions.
Thank you. Our first question comes from M of Massachusetts.
Good afternoon. My question is for Scott, and it's been something I've been meaning to write you about and didn't know how to do it, so this is perfect. It has to do with the pedestrian ramps, and when it comes to putting the detectable warnings in, what I'm finding up here is that It does help inform people who are with the Commission for the Blind of the changing, but it's having a larger negative impact on people with other disabilities. And is it possible to minimize the amount of the detectable warnings? Because the individuals in the wheelchairs are complaining the bumps, you know, are painful for them. I, who walk with a cane, now will try to find the curb because it throws my cane feeling off in how I lean and my balance. Others with walkers, especially the elderly who are not strong enough to lift their walker but put, you know, the tennis balls on the bottom to slide, now have trouble pushing up the curb cut. So I'm wondering if there's a way that we can't all get a nice mix so more people can use it and possibly put in a smaller detectable band.
Well, it's funny that you bring that up because that's exactly what the discussion was when the advisory committee was working on this stuff. Is because if you look at the existing guideline in ADAG, it's for the entire depth and width of the ramp has to have detectable warnings. Our requirements in the public right-of-way guidelines is basically the bottom 2 feet of the curb ramp has to have detectable warnings. So we've already reduced it by, if it's a standard 6 foot long ramp, we've already reduced that detectable warning requirement by, instead of 6 feet, it's only 2 feet. We had representatives from all types of disabilities on the advisory committee, and they all realized that, you know, it's all well and good that we take these curb ramps and put them in for us guys in wheelchairs to whip off of the sidewalk real fast and whip back on, but it takes away the cue for the blind pedestrian. And so this was kind of like a way of getting kind of middle of the road, because 2 foot is pretty common already for transit platforms. So. And it's sufficient for transit platforms, so that's why we felt comfortable with doing the 2 feet. So, yeah, we already have reduced it from what was originally required. I don't know I'm not sure I mentioned that in my presentation, and I apologize for that. So.
But I think transit platforms are flat, so they're easier as where you're placing them. In this one, it's at a slope, so that's where some of the problematic part comes in as well. I was looking for more of a 1 foot, if it's going to be at the bottom. Or is there a way to put the tactile warning at the top before they start to the slope?
The problem is there was a lot of research done on how detectable, when it's detectable and when it's not. The problem with only a 1 foot strip is that it can easily be stepped over. And you don't get that cue underfoot that you're actually on a detectable warning. You could completely skip the detectable warning. That's why the 2 foot minimum was based on research that we conducted. So I understand the problem, and you know, it's always a problem in this realm. Is meeting the needs of one group may affect the other group, and it's kind of a tightrope that we have to walk. So
Thank you so much for your question. Bonnie, do we have another question?
Yes, ma'am. Our next question comes from Arnie of California.
Yes, I'd like to know who's going to enforce these regulations we discussed today.
Ultimately, the Department of Transportation and the Department of Justice will do the enforcement.
But we write to the Department of Justice, and they don't have time to look into the situation.
If you, Arnie, if you get a hold of us after the call today, we can help you and give you the contact information for the Department of Transportation, and we even have some information on how to file a complaint with them. So give our number a call, and which I'm going to type into the chat section here for you, but give us a call, and we'll help you out with that, okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. I know we're running over just by a couple minutes, but since we haven't taken very many questions, I think we might take a couple more, and then obviously if we don't get to your question, you can give us a call afterwards. But Bonnie, let's go ahead and take the next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Don of Wisconsin.
Good afternoon. it may be an oxymoron for those of us who live in hard winter climates to think about a livable community, but are there any communities that you've seen that have had enlightened policies or done particularly good job in terms of snow removal that would affect the pedestrian way and certainly crossing the streets?
Anyone?
I have it in my BlackBerry, but I need to open it because it's not in my brain. So maybe if we go on to the next question and come back to it, I will find it in that.
Don, I tell you what, give us a call afterwards, and I'll, in the meantime, I'll get the answer from Jana, and we'll provide it to you, okay?
Great.
Thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes from Denise of Idaho.
This is for Scott. What is MUTDCD?
Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. It's basically Federal Highways
Design Bible.
Design standard for traffic control devices.
signals and pavement marking and signs.
Yeah, all those things.
So I have the answer to Don's question. This is per Dan Burden, because I asked this question because we were struggling with that in Arlington County, Virginia, after we got about 54 inches of snow this year and lacked a good snow removal ordinance. And Dan Burden, who's well known nationally, internationally, as a pedestrian bicycle advocate, walkable communities expert, he says Bozeman, Montana, Keene, New Hampshire, Hamburg, New York, and East Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I don't know the details of their policies or the implementation, but you might check in with those communities.
Great. Bonnie, I think we'll take one more question.
Thank you. That will be from Sheila of California.
Sheila?
Sheila, your line is open.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering if you have information regarding the use of adult crossing guards that are not associated with a school, like maybe for a senior center?
I don't think we have any. Is there something specific you're wanting to know?
Well, can we do that? I was looking in the MUTCD and the CBC both have sections regarding the use of crossing guards, but it's always associated with schools, and we're always worried about liability issues. And wondering if you have any experience or know of other communities that do those types of things where they have adult crossing guards that are maybe associated with a senior center.
I don't know of any. That's something, and I see people around the table shaking their heads no. So I don't think we have any examples for you. This is something that we could assist you with in doing some research. So why don't you give us a call afterwards, and we will do a little research and see if we can find a community that does that. But off the top of our heads, we can't think of any.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much. Unfortunately, we have ran over just a couple of minutes. But I do have a couple of closing comments before we end for the day. I know that we all want to thank Lucinda and Jana and Scott for the wonderful presentations and the great information. I want to thank Better World and Let's Go Expo for the assistance with the technology today. And thank you especially to all of those that joined us for the call today. As I mentioned earlier, if you're interested in obtaining a transcript of the program today, you can go to our website at projectaction.org somewhere in the next few weeks, 30 to 45 days, and we'll have that posted for you. If you would like the transcript in Braille or audio CD, you can make that request to espadistancelearning@easterseals.com and make sure you give us your postal address. Jana and Scott, do you have any final comments?
You might want to just mention that the PowerPoint is also on your website, isn't it?
Yes, thank you. The PowerPoint, we have had some questions come in on the chat section there. The PowerPoint is on the event website and can be downloaded from there, so you can have everything that we talked about today. And we'll leave that up there for quite a while. So help yourself to that if you'd like. Jen, any comments?
No further comments.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for your participation, and we hope that each of you will participate in the remaining two sessions in the online conference series. In the registration confirmation email that you received, there is the connection information. Each session has a different conference code. After the final session of the series, we will email a link to everyone with an event evaluation, and it's also going to be available on our website. You can access it there as well. And we're going to ask that you please take a moment to give us the feedback on this series of sessions. But most importantly, thank you for your commitment to bringing together the disability community and the transportation industry to improve accessible transportation in your community. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.